Money FM 89.3, best of weekends.
Joining us now on the line is Steve Okun, our regular contributor for our international news review. Steve, great to see you. Great to have you on again.
You know, I hate to say it, I'm probably more optimistic today than I have been in weeks or months. I mean, we're actually starting to see good news.
Well, let's hear it. I can't wait. So let's start first with the what's going on with the recount, with the Trump challenges in court. Where do we stand? I think there were something like 30 plus lawsuits already that have been thrown out. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the good sign, because what's happening now is that, you know, Trump is bringing these frivolous lawsuits, and he's losing literally every single one. He just had a major loss in Pennsylvania within the last few hours, where the judge said, you've given nothing, you've alleged nothing. You want to say there's one or two ballots that are in question, you don't want to throw $5 million? We're just not going to stand for it. And, you know, that press conference with Rudy Giuliani, you know, having the hair dye or, you know, eye dye or whatever it was, you know, dripping down in his face, is a big deal, because it's the image people are going to have of this clown show, where the case is literally melting away in front of people's eyes. So I think we're nearing the end of this, you know, of this circus that the Trump and Giuliani have been orchestrating.
Steve, one of the interesting side notes to this was Rudy Giuliani's son, and of course Donald Trump's son, now have COVID, are positive for COVID-19. And I had read that Giuliani was going to have to, because he was near his son in recent days, was going to have to quarantine for 2 weeks. Now, one would assume that that would impact his ability to go to court and to argue any of these cases if, in fact, they were being argued in person. Do we know anything more about that particular element of the court cases?
Well, here's the more important thing, I think, to think about on the court cases, as opposed to who's arguing them, is to what's being argued. In court, when you're a lawyer, you can't lie. If you lie, the judge can immediately fine you, and eventually you could take away your license to practice law. So you don't lie when you're in court. Mm. So Giuliani in a press conference will say, there's fraud. He gets in front of a judge. He says, this case isn't about fraud. Because if he did, he would be lying to the judge.
Oh.
And so it's not that Giuliani can't go in front of a judge. It's that nobody can go in front of a judge and lie. And every time they make an assertion outside the courtroom and a judge asks them about it inside the courtroom, they have to admit the assertion is false or that there's no basis in fact for it. That's the bigger deal. And they're running out of time. States are certifying their electors now. Georgia did it. Michigan's about to do it. Pennsylvania will soon do it. And this you know, this ridiculousness, which is actually extraordinarily harmful to the country, is soon going to come to an end.
There was a recent poll that I saw, and I think there's more than one, that indicates that some massive number, like over 60% or 70% of Republicans, believe Trump's line that the voting was fraudulent on a large scale. There was massive fraud, whatever massive means to an individual. You've certainly seen that. What kind of precedent, what kind of environment does that create when so many people believe that the election was not legitimate? Or is that going to go away along with the lawsuits when they are thrown out?
Look, I'm hopeful it goes away in a bit, because what you saw happen is that while you don't see, with a few notable exceptions like Mitt Romney, the Republicans in Washington, D.C. standing up for the truth and for the greater good, you're seeing Republicans in state capitals doing that. Trump has pressured the Michigan state officials who are Republicans,
right,
to not certify the vote. They said they won't do that. Michigan voted for Biden. Therefore, even though we're Republicans, of course, we're going to recognize the will of the people.
Yeah.
Pennsylvania Republicans are doing that. Georgia Republicans are doing that. So I'm hopeful that it will come down a bit. There are always going to be the Trump true believers who say it's impossible for him to lose. If he lost, it had to be fraud. But I'm hopeful that when more and more Republicans come out, which they're going to do, and they're starting to do, that'll take that down a bit.
Yeah. Okay. A lot to get ongoing with that, right? I mean, just when you thought the election was over 2 weeks ago, the election is over, but the fallout from the election is not over.
Right.
It is interesting, though, because even on Fox News and some of the traditionally pro-Trump media, you know, even many of those guys are questioning, you know, some of these claims that Giuliani has made with that have been proven demonstrably false when he said this particular incident was a case of fraud, et cetera. So even the right wing is starting to call him out on that.
No, exactly. I mean, because it's not true. I mean, we live in a democracy, yeah. And the core basis for a democracy is you respect the results of the people and that you have a peaceful transfer of power. And we've done this for over 200 years and we're going to do it now. And that this is where you put country over party. It's starting to happen. And now when the question is, when Trump leaves the Oval Office and he leaves the White House on January 21st at noon, is he going to be able to continue this type of poisoning of the respect right. for democracy? To some degree, I think he's going to, maybe more than I had thought, you know, a couple of weeks ago, but it's getting better. And that's why, again, why I'm in a good mood today.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Let's move on. We've got major trade on the docket in the media. The APEC leaders met the other day. Then we had the G20 is meeting today, yesterday and today. ASEAN met last week. There's so much happening, and many of these conversations are revolving around how to kickstart global economies, how to kickstart the trade systems that have been down, as well as talking about COVID-19 and supplying vaccines to poor countries and things like that. So much happening. How do we break down these different meetings and these different outcomes?
Well, I think there's one key thematic to keep in mind, and I wrote about this in my op-ed for the Straits Times on Friday, and that we're seeing this return to multilateralism, this respect for multilateralism, the need for multilateralism to address the core problems we face, the existential problems we face as a planet. It's with pandemics and the climate and you know, income inequality, which is what trade can help alleviate. And I'll tell you the good thing about Donald Trump in is that he taught two things. One, he took the U.S. out of the multilateral system. He left, you know, Paris. He left the WHO. He's trying to break the WTO. And now the U.S. recognizes, Democrats and Republicans, multilateralism does work for the U.S. The other thing that Trump did was that he showed other countries, you've got to step up. You can't be a free rider anymore. You're going to have to commit more to multilateralism. You're going to have to put more money into it. You're going to have to play by fairer rules. And so you're seeing a return to multilateralism, and it may even be stronger because of what Donald Trump did for these past 4 years. And so you're seeing it with the G20 saying, we've got to figure out collectively how we're going to get the vaccine to everybody, not just keep it, you know, for the rich countries. You see it with the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which came out of ASEAN and APEC. It's not an initiative of either two, but both of those, you know, made that come together. And you see the new APEC goals, trying to figure out how are we going to foster trade? How are we going to have more multilateralism? So positive news. Look, it's early days, but I think the trends are going in the right directions. And the business community needs to be following this as much as governments do.
In an interesting side note, a sidebar story that I saw as at the G20 opening yesterday, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia, was giving the opening address. And at the same time that he was giving the opening address, President Trump could be seen looking down at his desk. And moments later, he popped out a tweet about how unfair the election was. So, he clearly wasn't even listening to the opening address at the G20. And you talk about multilateralism, at least at one address, 1600 Pennsylvania, it doesn't seem to really have sunk in yet that about listening to others and working with others.
if he's not tweeting, he's playing golf. So you've got kind of two choices for the president
unreal.
Right now.
But yeah. These different deals, and I spoke with Dennis Hugh of the APEC Policy Support Unit just a few minutes ago, and he indicated that there is a renewed sense of urgency and understanding that, you know, countries have to come together, trading blocks have to come together to get everybody out of this, you know, crazy predicament that they're in. Do you feel like that is going to work for Singapore and for the businesses in this part of the world?
I'm going to say yes, but look, it's not clear. And there are competing, and I listened to that great interview you had with him, and you talked about, you know, the rising nationalism and protectionism. That's not going away either. So you've got these competing, you know, competing goals where governments recognize, yes, we need to integrate more, we need to have more trade. But at the same time, you see a country like, you know, Vietnam saying, well, we're going to require all data to be onshored, right? We're going to have all these data localization requirements. And look, if you don't have the free flow of data, how are you going to have the free flow of goods? How are you going to have free trade? So you've got these competing interests in a country like Vietnam, which is integrating on the one hand, but at the same time worrying about cybersecurity, which takes them in a different direction. You look at the United States, which is saying, what is the lesson we learned from the pandemic? We need to reshore. We can't rely on countries for our for PPE. We can't rely on countries for pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. So you're having these competing interests, and it's going to be, look, it's going to be bumpy in how they work out. I don't want to be Pollyannish and say everybody's going to come together. We're going to have regional trade now. It's all going to work out well. Partially it's moving in that direction, but it's partially moving in the other direction, and you're going to have to find a balance. But at least we have a multilateral approach by everybody who's now seeing that's the way to address things. It's not bilateral, and it's not being a free rider.
Yeah. At the APEC meeting, Chinese President Xi Jinping was invited to attend. He did. And through that meeting, at that meeting, he indicated that he would positively consider joining the CPTPP. And how big of a deal is that? I mean, of course, this was the deal that the U.S. was supposed to own, which was going to box in China and make sure that China played by the trade rules all those years ago that the U.S. was dealing and negotiating this. If China comes on board with this, what does that do to that deal in terms of our regional trading environment, our global trading environment?
Okay. Well, what China would have to do to come into that deal, as it's drafted now, and there's no reason to believe it would change, they would have to level the playing field when it comes to state-owned enterprises. They are not going to be able to subsidize all of their SOEs. They're not going to be able to protect them from competition if they come into the TPP. They're going to have to amend a lot of their intellectual property rules because there's intellectual property chapters in the TPP. They're going to have to open up more for foreign direct investment. So China to come into the CPTPP means they have to take a lot of internal structural reforms, which many would argue, myself included, that's in their ultimately national interest because it is going to make their economy stronger. But it's going to also open them up to a lot of foreign competition. It's going to require them to be much more transparent. So I don't see any indication that China is going to do the internal reforms needed before it can join CPTPP.
Is it possible they could negotiate out some of those points and still join the CPTPP?
Okay, short answer, no. Now, you can have carve-outs. So certain governments have carve-outs to say we're not going to be part of this because of our national laws. But you'd give China a carve-out. You give people time. You know, you say, okay, well, you've got to rewrite all of your intellectual property rules. Well, that's going to take years. So we're going to give you 3 years before you have to meet this commitment. But to say that China can pick and choose what it wants out of CPTPP, we'll take the tariff reductions, but we're not going to have SOE reform. No, that would not fly with governments like Singapore, Australia, Japan, Canada, Mexico, all who would have to agree to that. That's not going to happen.
Okay, let's close out, Steve, with a story that is, I think, from a diplomatic standpoint, quite interesting and explosive on one level, and that is the head of the Tibetan government in exile has visited the White House for the first time in 60 years. Lobsang Sangye is the president of what's called the CTA, the Central Tibetan Administration, meeting with the newly appointed U.S. Special Coordinator for Tibetan Issues. This is a massive line in the sand that the Trump administration has crossed.
And what's interesting to see is how Beijing will react to this, because, you know, Trump will be out of the presidency at noon on January 20th. He is president from now until that time, and he has full executive authority to do what he wants. You know, you could see along these lines of engaging with Tibet, something the United States has never done. Maybe Secretary Pompeo goes to Taipei 101 for New Year's Eve this year, and you have a Secretary of State visit Taiwan for the first time ever. Right. You're going to see the the China hawks in the Trump administration push as hard as they can to have that confrontation between the U.S. and China, make life difficult for a Biden administration. Now, the question is, can China restrain itself for the next 60 days, not react to these provocations, and then when the Biden team comes in, have those negotiations that need to be had on the economy, but on these issues as well? So I think we know what the Trump administration is going to do. Question is, what is President Xi and the party going to do in reaction, if anything?
Steve, are these not potentially good things for people on the left as well? I mean, this type of engagement is something that Democrats would surely see as a positive thing, talking to allies, whoever they may be. This isn't necessarily a bad thing. And does it perhaps give the Biden administration some air cover because Trump has done it and it's been done? And as a lame duck, nothing really can happen to Trump in this case. When Biden comes in, he can say, hey, look, it wasn't me. You know, Donald Trump started that ball rolling, so we're just going to carry on with it.
Well, you're 100% right to focus on the fact that the view on China in the United States is bipartisan. Democrats and Republicans have the same view. Business community and NGOs more or less have the same view now, or certainly a lot closer than they ever were before. So the question is, can the Trump administration do things that beyond a meeting like this, right, that's a one-off, can they change rules? Can they put on sanctions? Can they put on immigration challenges that would be tough for Biden politically to underdo, even though if he would have the full executive authority to do those as president? Those are the things to watch. Are there going to be more companies sanctioned? Are there going to be media kicked out of the United States? Or are there going to be immigration bans on Chinese officials that party members can't get visas? Those, which could be politically popular, will they not give Biden air cover, but will they be tough for Biden to undo if he wanted to do them politically? That's the thing I'm really going to focus on in the next 2 months from the Trump administration.
Steve Okun, Senior Advisor, McClarty Associates, as always, thank you so much for being with us on our International News Review.
Thank you, Glenn.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SBH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.